everybody. Thanks for tuning in. If you're new to the program, my name is Henrik, and you are, of course, listening to Red Ice Radio. We are based out of Sweden. We cover tons of different topics that we find to be among the most interesting and important. And we go all across the board and talk with many different people from different perspectives to gauge, to inquire, to collect information, and, of course, an effort to understand and know more about the world. We encourage you, as always, to make the final call as to the importance and weight of the material that we discuss. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com, that's our websites. Today we're going to talk with a man who doesn't do too many interviews. He's behind the website BATR.org, that's Breaking All the Rules. His name is James Hall, and one of the main topics that he covers on the website is totalitarian collectivism. And this is one of the areas that we'll focus on today. But we'll also go into political correctness, government worship, cultural utopia, and human nature. Well, welcome, James Hall. Thank you for taking the time off, coming on, talking with us today. It's great to have you with us.
You're very gracious for the invite, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to address your audience.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, you have a very interesting website, James. A lot of good articles on there. I've been getting some of your newsletters and mail send-outs for, I believe, a couple of years now. I've been following a lot of the writings there. So I wanted to bring you on and obviously talk a little bit about totalitarian collectivism, one of the main tenets that you focus on, if you will, on the website. But before we do that, if you don't mind, James, tell us a little bit about the background on the website and why you wanted to start Breaking All the Rules.
Well, Breaking All the Rules is a catchy title that basically gets the attention of people. Quite to the contrary, I'm a very paleo-conservative individual that's looking to defend Western civilization more than to tear it down. That's not to say that I'm defending many of the institutions that we are all living under. But Breaking All the Rules attracts people of all different political persuasions, and we basically try to elicit thought-provoking questions in each one of our articles and to create what the significance is of a topic that we deal with. So Breaking All the Rules has a body of work of over 13 years, and we probably have more paleo-conservative viewpoints on the web than mostly any other columnist that's out there.
And that is, of course, very different from the version of conservatism that we get to us today and that most people who are younger know of. So before we kind of talk about that a little bit more, just tell us more about the name Breaking All the Rules. How did that come about? Is that more because it was difficult to kind of, I guess, put you in a category in terms of politics, philosophy, and ideology, or how did that come about?
Well, the problem is that the rules set down for everyone on this planet are not internalized by each individual. We're being forced to accept a whole myriad of rules, regulations, and laws that fundamentally are not agreed by individuals because of the way that they want to live their own life. So breaking the rules basically is an inherent function that every human being should have, that they're willing to demonstrate and have proactive action to go out and to challenge the establishment wherever they come across.
Absolutely. Now, do you think that we've gotten, is this something we've gotten bad, if you will, at doing in the Western world of questioning and of breaking those rules that have been set up around us? I mean, we certainly do have a different environment between Europe and America as well. In America, you guys have a tradition of coming from that kind of mentality, if you will, of a lot of people from Europe. They fled from the feudal times at that stage. They wanted something new. They were daring enough. They were brave enough in some regards to take that risk and those chances as well. Therefore, you had a different type of person living in America during that time. But are we still doing that? Are you guys still doing that in America in these days?
Well, I spent some time in the UK. We made probably 15 to 20 visits over the last 20 years. And for me to do and to write the way I do in the UK, I would probably be hauled in to the authorities. that doesn't mean that freedom of speech in the United States is recognized as a human right to the extent that it once did. I try to bring a historic perspective to my writing, but yet at the same token, I'm trying to get to the significance of our own lifespan, if you will. And I would say within the last 50 years, there's been a dramatic change in the United States away from what the dream was, what the principles were, and we are living in what we would call the totalitarian collectivism of a state function government in cooperation and in coordination with the corporatists. And that we really have an axis, if you will, between government and corporations that basically have operated in such a way to destroy the meaning and the significance and the practice of what our Bill of Rights protections were at the inception of the country.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think many people even think when you said, you know, that you have your background in, you know, paleoconservative, people think conservative and then think, well, oh, okay, so you're for all the corporations out there that are basically, you know, running the government at this stage. But that's very far from the truth, of course. Tell us more about the how this partnership, you know, arose, the corporate corporatocracy, if you will, that we are in today in most of the Western world. How did that come about from a historical point of view?
Well, it really does, it really starts with the bankers, and it's all financial. You know, we're just celebrating the 100th year of the Federal Reserve in the United States, which is nothing more than an offset, if you will, of the Bank of England. And during this past 100 years, the purchasing power of the currency, once known as the U.S. dollar, but is now the Federal Reserve notes, has gone down about 99.5% from what it was previously to the inception of the Federal Reserve. It starts with the bankers, and frankly, it ends with the bankers, and you can trace back every war or every international conflict that the United States has participated in, and in the last post-World War II, I would argue that the American Empire has basically become the real axis of evil in the world. I'm a very staunch anti-interventionist.
Yeah.
And the way that this country, the United States, operates is to for the benefit of the corporate interests. And the corporate interests are fundamentally owned by the banks. And to dismiss that argument and not to accept the truth based on the historic context is really missing the entire significance of the history of the last 100 years.
Yeah, it's true, you know. And if we get into, there are different components to the structure of how things look today and how that's come about. As you said, one of the main tenets is totalitarian collectivism, but weaved into this, you also have political correctness these days and all the things that are basically limiting people from living the lives that they want, of having the natural rights, if you will, given to them. But let's deconstruct what you mean when you say totalitarian collectivism and what that's comprised of, if you will.
Well, okay, on the particular site entitled TC, if you will, which is can be reached from the Breaking All the Rules site, I break down the components into 10 basic introductory articles. One is the state, one is the church, one is the family, one is the economy, one is schools, one is the media. And I put two under corporations, one corporation and the law, and the corporation state, the corporate state. And the last one is the global controllers. In essence, what we have under collectivism, and you can lap together all the isms, whether they're communism, socialism, fascism. They're really nothing more than a dependency on some type of governmental or economic structure that is not being earned by the individual in a viable merchant-style economy. The totalitarian aspect is frankly, just like every other government that's ever existed throughout all of human history. It's based on force, coercion, and authoritarianism. When you bring both of those components together, and you end up having a population that not only is unwilling to fight against it, but in most cases embraces it and welcomes the expansion of the collectivism, you're in a complete civilization decay.
Yeah.
And that's the condition of the United States. We're basically a country that has become so dependent on what government does, and over 50% of the population is receiving some type of government subsidies of some sort. And when you look at the major growth employer in the United States being the federal government, there's very little hope that one could effectively vote these people out of office that are creating the situation, because they all have pensions. They all are maintaining careers to advance, and the way they do that is to expand government larger and larger.
And tell us more about this, because it seems that the problems that they create in their wake as well is also the very reasoning why they should exist. In other words, as you said, the more people are dependent on the situations that they create, the more likelihood that they will go away will never occur. The very existence of the system itself, the structure, is to perpetuate itself, is to grow larger, to take more and more control over, you know, the most mundane things in people's lives. So it's very clear at that stage that we're dealing with something which we, I don't think we, it's largely like a beast. We don't understand how to begin to make it grow smaller. Just look at the European Union, for example, the state that's turned into, the whole scenario with the law system in the EU. It's just, they never diminish. They never get smaller. They just get bigger and bigger and bigger, right? That's kind of the way it works.
At this point, we're at a somewhat of a historic juncture, because the globalism that has taken over the corporate economy of the world has absolutely no pushback. The trade treaties, the WTO, the manufactured crises, which has been the derivative implosion, if you will, papered over with sovereign debt obligations. We're at a point where the debt of the world is mathematically impossible not to pay off. That was never intended.
Yeah.
But it's impossible to even service. And if you can't service the debt, you can't grow any type of an economy. And the fact that Asia supposedly is this growth engine is really a major misnomer to the world economy, because it cannot overtake the obligations that the Western nations have to maintain the central banking system that's at the heart of all the debt creation and obligations that all nations have. And from the standpoint of the taxpayer, all this means is a diminished standard of living, an inability to have a future. And in the United States, at this point, the middle class is shrinking, and we're all becoming a dependent society.
You know, James, I always wondered if this has been a part of the objective to not only run the economy of the world into the ground, but many other aspects of government and the structure around us, so that eventually, when things get bad enough, we'll reach a situation where people are going to demand that something is to be done about it. And at that stage, what is going to be introduced, I fear, is going to be something that's far more, you know, even dangerous and collectivized and state-run than it is today. What is your opinion on that?
Well, historically, whenever governments get into trouble, they start wars. And the war aspect is something that should not be overlooked or diminished at this particular time. you know, it's been said that war is so frightening at this point that it can't really happen. So we have all these little ongoing skirmishes that cost hundreds of billions of dollars to service, but yet at the same token keeps a lid on things. Well, let's be honest. We're in a technocratic society. And the globalists fundamentally do not have need for the population base. Extermination of hundreds of millions of people is something that is very real. Now, I have no doubt that the powers that be, which are controlling all the governments, and the governments are not the controlling elements at all. They're nothing more than like Tony Blair's poodle to Bush, if you will, back in the last administration.
Right.
The issue basically is that they create false flags to create situations that demand some type of response. 9/11 is an absolute fraud, and anyone who basically takes the time and has the intellectual integrity to examine the facts and to do their own homework and to tune off the media, the cultural narrative that goes on from the mass media is just psychological warfare on people.
Yeah.
It all has to not only be discounted, it has to be ignored because there's no truth in news reporting at this particular juncture in our lives.
Absolutely, you're definitely right. It's very much like we're living in a theater at this stage, and everything, all the conflicts that we see, all the made up boogeymen of the world seems to be under the control of this same centralized body. And I've always speculated that, of course, the best way of controlling a conflict is to control both sides of that conflict, so you don't have an unknown variable that potentially can detopple a regime or anything like that, but. What do you think then in terms of the expansion of the war industry? I mean, that's to a certain degree something that has been, unfortunately very beneficial to a lot of people because again, with their corporations, with the weapons manufacturing, with even the fact that people in America have the ability to pay off their student loans if they join the military. It's been like one of the only engines that's left in America, really, right?
Well, unfortunately. The American public did not heed the warnings of President Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. Now we have a military-industrial security complex.
Yeah.
The security aspect is the most bogus creation of a useless governmental function that the United States ever adopted. They just approved... the Senate finally voted to approve the budget for next year for military expenditures, which include an expansion of the NDAA legislation that fundamentally allows the government to categorize any dissident, if you will, and categorize them as a terrorist and just fundamentally scoop them up and put you in a black hole. It's reminiscent of the type of attitude that was used against Ezra Pound
right.
at the end of World War II.
Yeah.
And the point is, now it's going mainstream, and the public is just oblivious to the loss of their civil liberties. As a paleoconservative, civil liberties are one of the top three tier elements that have to be protected. The other two is an anti-interventionist foreign policy, and the third is an honest money aspect.
Yeah.
But the civil liberties have not even been addressed in this country for in my lifetime, really in the last 50 years. I come out of the anti-war Vietnam period, and I had dealings with the ACLU back in those days. And frankly, they were against Vietnam and against all the aspects of the type of imperialism that was being practiced at that point. Today, the ACLU is anathema to civil liberties.
Hmm.
They have nothing to do. The left has abandoned all the principles that they purported to embrace. The only people that are fighting actively for civil liberties are some of the groups on the right side of the ledger, if you will, which are, you know, right and left are really meaningless at this point, but people like John Whitehead. And I know you've had him on.
Yeah.
Whitehead is a wonderful exponent of civil liberty.
Indeed, indeed. Well, is it also not because the many people on the left, they hope that when the state grows larger, that they will kind of be a part of that piece, if you will, that as long as we have a big government and as long as it's on the right, you know, within the right realm of the political spectrum, they argue, then it's going to be okay kind of thing, as opposed to seeing, well, wait a minute, if we do get an expansion of the state and the state takes over more and more and more control, eventually you're going to have the wrong people take control of that apparatus, and then at that point it's going to be so large and so big that it's going to be impossible to detopple it or do something about it, right? But this idea that you're going to be in on the decision making, or you're going to get a piece of the cut or something like that, that's the childish behavior, right?
I read a lot of political discourse from all sides, and I keep track of left-leaning publications, and I kind of amused at times that they are so good at articulating what the problem is, and they're so absolutely oblivious to reality. They're living in a cognitive dissonant environment of their cultural utopia. They do not understand human nature, nor are they willing to accept it for what it is. What we are living through, and what the left is never going to fully understand, we're living through the new feudalism. You know, the Occupy movement will complain about the 1%. Well, it's not the 1% what the problem is. It's the 0.0005%, if you will.
Sure.
It's the people who control all the financial mechanisms, institutions, cross-board arrangements, all the levers of wealth production that are now synonymous with government largesse. When you have people like Warren Buffett, the primary welfare recipient in the United States because of his political connections, you know, this is not capitalism practice in the United States. And I don't view myself as a capitalist. I view myself in my economics as a free entrepreneur enterprise person,
right,
who bases his economic model on the merchant class. And the merchant class means you have to have a strong, independent, small business economy, not global transnationals that have no allegiance to any country, and basically manipulate the tax laws through their own lawyers and their accountants and their lobbyists to write into the law special treatment, because we have nothing more than crony capitalism from the perspective of who contributes the most amount of money to the political process gets the biggest benefit from the legislation that comes out of it.
Well, I think, John, the biggest, proof, if you will, that I have for that is just what's currently is going on within Sweden, because we have, of course, an extremely big, government. The public spending is astronomical. It's based really on collectivism, those kinds of tenants and very high taxes and everything else. And what has happened, what eventually has happened, despite Sweden, Norway, Scandinavia overall being praised internationally I read that all the time in the press in the U.S. and England and everywhere, they're venerating the Nordic model and all these things. But what people who are for, you know, socialism and stuff like that don't seem to understand is that when you get that type of government and that type of structure in place, the first ones that are going to go out the door are the smaller business owners. You have basically nothing left in Sweden except the big mega corporations that are working in cooperation, in bed with the government. And then you have a few, maybe one or two person, businesses in operation, those who can maintain it on that level. But in between there's very few to those businesses who can expand on beyond, take in, 10, 20, 30 employees or grow and start to become competitive on a larger market. So you have, again, you have a severing of those ideas that people think that would come if more socialism were to be brought in. So that's what I've seen in my country anyway.
Well, I've had the privilege of having a very diverse experience, not only in politics, in business, and in academics. And my firsthand experience as a business person can testify that the small business individual is at a distinct disadvantage when the economy is good. When the economy reverts to the corporate model of handouts, if you will, which is what we're experiencing since the financial meltdown of 2008,
yeah,
it would be almost impossible to be a small business person and to survive against the corporate juggernaut. Now, for your listeners, I will have to admit and acknowledge that I basically sold out a very profitable business, small business, but large by most people's standards, to a Fortune 500 company.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that because I knew I could not compete long term.
Right.
I just could not have access to the amount of capital necessary to grow the business and to make it the number one or number two within my marketplace, in that the opportunity presented itself and I basically, well, I sold out.
Right.
So my principles are nice to listen to, but yet at the same token, I'm a very pragmatic, practical, hard-nosed businessman that's also a politician that could never be elected in this country.
Right, right.
Now, what we have with the Obamacare debacle is that it's like the last nail in the coffin of small business.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever amount of implosion that we're experiencing now about Obamacare, the political process is still that it's the law of the land. And no matter what the executive branch does illegally, which is what Obama does constantly, operating government by executive order, we have a law that's on the books that companies are going to have to adhere to or be in violation. Now, it may be postponed for a year, but I guarantee you it's not going to be repealed. From all the rhetoric and from all the people that are upset, you could have 75% of the people in polls against Obamacare, and the political class is not going to repeal it.
Yeah.
They may modify certain aspects of it, but I guarantee you that when it comes down to it all, the people that work in this country, that have a job, that are used to having health insurance through their employer, they're all going to be thrown to the wolves.
Yep.
Because the employer cannot afford it. And what is left is going to be just one absolute diminished in quality healthcare system that's going to go bankrupt. Now, that's just the latest example from a political aspect as to what are Americans really concerned about. Well, from the longer-term aspect, the United States was the great differential country because it was a place where the rule of law was maintained, more so than any place else on the face of the earth. That doesn't exist any longer.
Yeah.
Natural law is something that no one talks about. There's no morals. There's no ethics. There's nothing when it comes to public policy that is constant. It is all relative situation ethics, and whatever the media tells you is the writing of history at the particular time is what the public, the public is not just apathetic. They're just plain downright dumb and stupid. And unfortunately, that's the only conclusion any rational, sensible person can come to. It's not a nice conclusion. It's something I wish was not the facts, but I deal in a world of facts and reality, not in some hyper-fantasy land where people think that everyone is going to hug each other and just get along. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's a very important point, though. I mean, from the point of view that as we look back into history, it's literally being rewritten in front of our eyes as we, you know, get stories. Everything is turned into social construct as opposed to, you know, realities and et cetera. But if we go and talk a little bit more about the human condition then, because ultimately I think that that is where the discussion ultimately leads. What are we? You know, how are we comprised? What are the tenets of how we're supposed to live? And as you say, natural rights is a very big part of that. You have something called, you know, inherent autonomy that you write about on the website, that this is the intrinsic nature of the human condition. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, inherent autonomy fundamentally argues and writes essays related to the sovereignty of the individual. I'm a Christian existentialist, and the point is very simple. There's a higher authority. I don't deal in institutional dogma, if you will, but yet at the same token, I accept Christianity as the only viable, sensible, and salvation offering philosophy that the world has ever come across. Now, I consider it to be a religion. I don't argue it from the standpoint of the religion. I argue it from the standpoint that it's the only system that makes sense. Our political persuasion is that of popularism, where the individual basically has the natural rights, the natural from natural law from a higher authority. Now, government has done everything within its power to destroy natural rights. I accept the tenets of Thomas Jefferson, even though many consider him to be just a deist, as opposed to the philosophy in practicality of implementation of a political structure of an Alexander Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
who was nothing more than a person who wanted to have an American British empire for himself.
Right.
I'm an anti-federalist. Inherent autonomy basically means that the authority of the government is only legitimate when it comes from the consent of the people who are willing to share their inherent right of authority with a government structure. I'm also a person who would argue, contrary to many conservatives, that the Constitution is not the greatest document in American history. Quite to the contrary, the Declaration of Independence. And the proper model for government was the Articles of Confederation. But our history has been so distorted. As a history major in undergrad school, and I had the privilege of a very good education with ours, I had to dislearn, if you will, everything that was taught to me. It was not true. It was not factually correct. You have to go back to the original documents. You have to go back to the sources of the debate at the time of the inception of the country to understand that the sovereignty of individual states in a federalist system of balance of power was the unique contribution of the United States to world political discourse. Certainly, many of the ideas of the Enlightenment were embraced by the founding fathers, but they knew, in terms of people like Jefferson, that a strong central government would ultimately destroy the very purpose of the American Revolution.
Right. Yeah.
And I completely commit to the ideas of the American Revolution to all nations. I completely advocate national sovereignty of ethnic groups, not based on arbitrary demarcation lines drawn on a map, but based upon the ability of those ethnic groups to rule themselves.
Right.
That's not the world we live in today. Quite to the contrary, the New World Order has as a goal to have only one authority.
That's right.
Their authority. And all the rest of us have to be slaves to that authority.
you write on the website, again, under inherent autonomy, that it is the intrinsic order of individual independence. Natural rights are the foundation upon which an authentic society rests. All rights are possessed by human beings. And then you go on to say governments or states do not retain rights. The only purpose is to serve, you know, citizens. So what do you think about what has happened here when we look at things like, you know, corporate personhood, for example, the invention of government and law ultimately to create corporations as fictional entities so that they can have the same rights as human beings and everything else. I mean, if people are tired of the corporate world and corporations, they should really look at who has invented them and who by law, you know, adheres to those types of principles of giving them the same, you know, quote unquote rights as human beings, right?
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go with the next input. Corporate personhood is an absolutely anti-intellectual conclusion. It is, by all Western thought and logic, it is impossible to come to that conclusion. And when we had the railroad case that the Supreme Court decided back in the 19th century that created personhood for corporations, it was a departure from the rule of law to such an extent that the ultimate conclusion is what we're living under today. And that's tyranny. Plain and simple. There is no basis of a corporation to have limited liability in the sense that it has no responsibility. A corporation is organized to maximize profit. It does not operate as a good citizen. It does not operate as a beneficiary to society. It operates for no other reason than to stamp out competition. And I do know something about that because I lived that for many years.
Yeah.
And fought against it. But the other side of the ledger, of corporate personhood are the courts. And the courts fundamentally have absolutely no legitimacy at any longer in the United States. They are nothing more than bought and paid for surrogates for the corporations. And I've had many canceled checks of lawsuits that I have been engaged in to prove that. We conducted a four-year battle against Industrial Wind here in our local community. And one of the companies that has been the developer of this project was a crony financial alliance of Obama directly, with Ron Emanuel having financial interests and Larry Summers being a paid consultant for the company that received $5 million for 6 months' work.
Yeah.
And once we tried to deal with it on a state level, and I live in New York State, so we're always up against a different political persuasion here in Western New York than what you would normally experience. People would think of New York in proper. We were hoping that the Supreme Court judge would at least follow the law, but of course they did not. And I've been involved with other legal cases all the way up to the Court of Appeals. The courts do not even abide by their own constitutions. It's called equity law. They decide whatever they choose to based on political reasons. The United States is operating under admiralty law. We do not really have a constitution at this point. Admiralty law, as students of the law understand and know, comes from the British experience where basically the ship's captain is the ultimate authority on the ship. And that type of approach is indicative of the way the entire legal process works in the United States. Just look at what constitutes a flag for the United States at this point and look at the yellow fringe that's on the extremities of the flag.
Right.
That signifies admiralty law. That means that they're acknowledging to anyone who has eyes to see that basically the Constitution is void. Your Bill of Rights are void. They give lip service to it, but when it comes into practice, they are ignored by the courts.
Interesting. So you were saying that in most court or all courtrooms in America, they have the yellow, the golden fringe around the flag?
Not only courtrooms, but also on municipal town halls.
Interesting.
Every governmental agency, whether it's administrative or judiciary, has the yellow fringe on the flag.
Interesting. So that's obviously, you know, maritime law. That's to circumvent the law of the land, as it were, then, right? So people are fighting on the complete wrong levels, I guess, if they're not aware of those principles.
Well, that's part of it. But let's take the other component of the law, and that's the attorney. Do people really understand that attorneys do not have a license to operate? It's the only profession I know of that does not have a license.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the attorneys are going to tell you that they're licensed, but what they are, they have approval from the Bar Association to practice law. Quite a different thing. The approval comes from other Esquire class, other lawyers. Not from a government procedure. It comes from basically the clique that fundamentally thinks they have greater privilege than anyone else within the political process. I've had dealings with as retainers for over 100 lawyers in my lifetime, based on the nature of the work that I did, and aspects of what I was engaged in, and I can testify from firsthand experience, not one of them really understands what the Constitution's about, let alone be willing to put down their professional career and basically fight for the Constitution. I know one lawyer who's a columnist for Lou Rockwell in Buffalo that basically I have good cordial relations with and have been involved with some litigation where he has filed very, very significant lawsuits. And we're doing another one right now against the Safe Gun Act in New York State, which basically abolishes, if you will, what is left of the Second Amendment here in New York State.
Huh.
But all the rest of the lawyers would take my money, but they would never support the Constitution.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's a lot of obviously issues at the very core of this, and you know, as we proceed here in a little bit in the second, I want to ask you more about how to obviously tackle some of these issues and what will occur if some of these problems basically goes unchallenged, you know, where things actually will end up when it comes to this both totalitarian collectivism, but then the whole, you know, corporatocracy that we find ourselves within right now. But before we go there, James, let's talk a little bit more about your website and give out some of the details on how people can, you know, find your writings if you do have something on the website that you'd like to, you know, mention or plug or anything like that. So please give us the details.
Well, the URL address, I will give you two. It's batr.org, which is the primary portal. And the secondary site is batr.net, which also has a very large form, which is open to the public. It's very daunting for someone who's a first-time visitor to our website, Breaking All the Rules, to try to navigate the wealth of information that's there. There are a number of search boxes that people I would encourage to put in what they're looking for, which is a good way to try to find the information. But we have like 13 separate series that we write on, and we rotate among different themes. We do one business article a week, and we do one political article a week, new articles.
All right, very good. Now, batr.org and batr.net, and that, again, of course, stands for Breaking All the Rules. Check that out. There's a lot of good articles on the website, a lot of material, you know, just as you said, James, a lot of things to sift through, but do have a look, because there's a lot on there for you. But yeah, we'll take a short break right here, James, and we'll be back with more in just a little bit. We'll be right back. Proceed in the second hour with James Hall to talk more about the World Bank, IMF, SDRs, and the Bank for International Settlements. We talk about how the state claims legitimacy, egalitarianism, and natural rights. James talks more about the war machine and how much of people's taxes actually goes to fund the wars. And we ask James to look ahead and see what he sees 10, 15 years down the road from now. Where will we be then? Tune in to the second hour at redicemembers.com. If you like what we do and want to hear more, sign up for a membership and get access to almost 800 radio programs on a lot of different topics that are, in my opinion, all connected and gives us a greater insight into the world and what really is going on. We also have videos, films, commentary, and much, much more for you guys coming here down the line. Well, thank you for listening. We have upcoming on Red Ice Radio, David Talbot, Walter Block, Richard Dewhurst, Dan Fogler, and Ben Davidson. Stay with us in the second. More is coming up. RedIceMembers.com.